took me many years to even go by Bundy and San Vicente. Every time I would go by there, I would become like nauseous or something. It would just really affect me. I'm Jill Shively, and I'm the witness that almost collided with O.J. Simpson on June 12th at the intersection of Bundy and San Vicente. I moved to Santa Monica about 1980. I've been living there ever since, up until that time. In 94, I was in the same place I'd been since 1985. I knew the area really well. My store to go to all the time was Westward Ho, which was in Brentwood, about 3 miles from me. And so that night on June 12th, I got in my car around 10:40, 10:45 at the latest, and I was heading east on San Vicente, trying to make it to Westward Ho by 11 p.m. And as I'm approaching Bundy is when I almost run into O.J. Simpson's Bronco. I would have probably seen the Bronco sooner, but there were no headlights on his car. I swerved to the right of me to miss him. He went up onto the median. There's a middle median right there to avoid hitting me. And I realized to avoid hitting a gray Nissan also on San Vicente heading west. So he had kind of both of us cornering him in. I'm staring at this person at the time. I didn't know who it was. And they're looking at me, glaring at me, as if I had done something to them. They were looking at me like, why did I almost hit them? They were glaring, giving me this angry look. And I was angry because I had a small little VW Bug. I thought it was gonna get hit and possibly killed. Being a single parent, I was really angry about that. So as I'm looking at him, he sticks his hand out of this car and yells at the Nissan to move, move. So they moved 3 times, going the same direction. OJ would back up, the Nissan would back up. Instead of going forward the opposite direction. Finally, the Nissan backed up and OJ's Bronco took off north on Bundy and his lights were still off. I remember seeing his brakes, tail lights, but his lights were still off. He didn't even turn them on. When he yelled, move, move, I realized who it was. It was OJ, because I had just seen the Naked Gun recent movie of him, and I recognized his voice. I thought he was a drunk driver, because why would you drive like that? He takes off, the Nissan backs up. He's still sitting there. We're watching OJ leave, and we kind of looked at each other, and then he took off west on San Vicente. And I just went ahead and went to Westward Ho, thinking I've got to get there by 11. And when I got there, the salad bar was down. I didn't get what I wanted. And then I just turned around and went back home. I made the phone call to report him as a drunk driver before midnight. I remember it was before midnight when I called in. I looked up the number. It was like I didn't call the 911, but I looked up West LA's LAPD phone number. And I think it was on Butler Avenue. And I called that number and I called and reported him as a drunk driver. I wanted to let them know that this self-entitled jerk was running around drinking and driving and they needed to do something about him. So the next morning I was waking up early around 6. I remember calling my mom because I would take my daughter over to her place because she would take her to preschool. So I said, hey, you know, I want to tell you what happened to me last night. OJ almost hit me. She goes, oh my gosh, it's all over the news. OJ's ex-wife and a friend were brutally murdered.
The bodies of Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman were discovered early Monday morning. Later, a police forensics team began a search of the crime scene and O.J. Simpson's
And I'm like, oh my God. So I was really, I felt scared at that time. She felt scared for me. And she was saying, but you better call them and let them know that And we kind of we talked about stuff. No, but I called him last night, and I let them know what he was doing and that I reported him, and I had his license plate number. She goes, oh, no, you should call again, because I told her the whole conversation about me calling it in, and the lady who took the phone call was kind of dismissive of me. Well, no one was injured or hurt. You didn't crash. So what report am I supposed to basically take? So I said, okay. So I'll call before I go to work. So I called again between 6 and 7, I think that before 7 that morning, and I called West LA again, said, hey, I want you to know what happened last night in case you didn't get that report or something you didn't get all the information. So this time when I called in, they were very attentive. They listened. The license plate number, I told them I had it. And then they said, okay, we took everything down. And then they said, we're gonna have some police come out to your home. And I think the next day is when the police officers came out. Two police officers came to my home, I think on the 13th or 14th, can't remember the exact date. They came to my home. They asked me what happened, exactly what I saw, who did I think it was, and could I describe the Bronco, and did I have the license plate number? And I told them, well, I know the last three numbers were 788. I can't remember if it was 3CWZ or 3CZW, but I said, I have those numbers down. It was a white Bronco with shiny rims, and the plate was a white plate. And then he wrote down the number on his card, and then he wrote down number down on a report. And they said, okay, no one will know you're a witness. So you just, you know, we will protect you. No one will know that you're involved. And then the next day, I'm getting bombarded by the media. They're coming to my door. So somehow people knew who that I was a witness and what was happening. So David Kahn was the original prosecutor on the case. He had just won the Menendez trial. So they wanted him to try the case. So he was my contact person with Phil Van Atter. And Phil Van Atter and David Kahn were my people that I would talk to about the case. They're the ones that interviewed me, did my background check, checked all my story out, checked the license plate out, and they confirmed that I... the timeline was what was the right timeline for me when OJ left the place, when they thought the murders had occurred. And he basically, David Kahn, was saying to me, hey, you know, I'm sorry about somehow your name got leaked. All the witnesses' names got leaked. They're getting bombarded with media. And there, you know, it's not much we can do. But just, you know, try to stay away from the media, try to stay hidden. And so then I had all these people come to my door, hard copy came to my door. They were saying, hey, you know, Jose Camacho has been talking, other witnesses are talking. I think it was, I don't know if he did or not, but Dale St. John was talking, other witnesses. So we need you to tell your story because we want to get it out now. So like they rushed me. I think I did the interview almost the same day on hard copy. And I remember trying to call Patty Jo Fairbanks. She was the witness coordinator. I had a number on a card. I couldn't reach her. But then it became evening. I did the interview with hard copy. The next day or two, I called, I think it was Patty Jo Fairbanks, finally got a hold of her, let him know, hey, I did this interview, and then that's when all hell broke loose. Marcia Clark called me into her office a couple times to get on me for doing this interview and blowing, she said, I blew her case. She got in my face and said I had blown her case. And then she didn't need me anymore because she had enough circumstantial evidence. I went to the grand jury. They picked me up. Marcia was there asking the questions to me. And then you're sitting in this large room full of the grand jury. But I just focused on Marcia. And I think she drew a diagram of my car, OJ's car, and the other guy's car. And we just, I just tried to stay focused on that. I could see, I thought they were taking notes and things. It was very nerve-wracking. And she was asking me basically what happened that night. And everything seemed fine. And then we were done with that grand jury. I don't think I was there for very long, maybe a couple hours.
Let's talk about the relationships now that you have.
Well, Tanya Brown is probably my favorite person. I met her through a mutual friend, I don't know, 10 years ago maybe, something like that. And we got to talk, and she was just such a sweetheart, so kind. So she was just like the starting point of where I was able to start healing my own self. I never got to meet any of the other key players until recently. I met Cato through his podcast with Tom Zenner. And Cato is such a sweetheart too. He's very kind. And it's kind of nice to be able to talk to him. And then I met Alan Park via the phone. We've talked a couple times. And it's kind of nice to be able to talk to someone like them because they understand where we all were at that time and how hounded we were and the emotions we went through and how the fear we went through. Like, if the trial, if OJ was convicted, was there going to be another riot? It was kind of feeling in fear for our lives sometimes. It's a shame that we all didn't get to talk and meet then because we kind of could have helped each other out because I felt like I was going through it alone. And I even had people come to my door and just become threatening to me that, you know, hey, if I testify, I'm part of the conspiracy to convict OJ. I'm prejudiced and all these things. So I had this guys were sent by Skip, somebody named Skip, and they offered me $40,000 to go on vacation. This is way before the even trial started. This is like preliminary stuff. And I said no. And I remember I had to hire an attorney to protect my, I felt unsafe. So I had to hire an attorney to get people to like back off, leave me alone. You just felt so unsafe and no one understood where you were coming from. Even my family, we had to move from where we stayed at a friend's beach house for like 2 years almost. So, and my daughter, people following us around, and she didn't understand why people were peeping in her window at night, looking as I'm putting her to bed. And it was just, it's so invasive and people were divided so strongly. And they were just wanting to make something out of anything I ever said or did. So it was, if I had the meeting like Tom Lang was always good to me from the very start, him and Phil Van Atter. I loved them both. They were always my advocate. They stood up for me. You know, they were always very good people. They stood up for me against Marcia a lot, and they couldn't understand why, you know, she wasn't using me. They had run every background check they could ever run on someone. So, but again, you just felt so alone because you go back to your family, and there I had some family members that they were just not happy with the situation. And they didn't like it that this was happening. It was, you know, they were getting harassed by media. I think one of my older brothers, the National Enquirer, he wanted him to sell a story on me. And so it was just all around.
And this case touched home for you, right?
Oh, yeah. We have an older sister in August of 94. She was beaten up and left for dead in a canyon by a boyfriend. So there was domestic violence case there too. At the time we got there, they had airlifted her to Henry Mayo up in Valencia, but by the time we got there, she had passed away. So yeah, after that, even I felt like this was blood money. I had definitely not supported domestic violence or that issue. I have such a compassion and respect for them and love for them, because I always make sure when we bring up one of their names, I bring up the other. If it's Nicole Brown, I want to make sure Ron's not excluded, and vice versa, because a lot of times people say one or the other, and they were both there that night, and I want to make sure that none of them ever become forgotten. Ron was there, I think, trying to protect Nicole, and he died because he was trying to help Nicole.
Did you ever go by the crime scene?
Not after the murders happened in 94. It took me many years to even go by Bundy and San Vicente. Every time I would go by there, I would become like nauseous or something. It would just really affect me. So I would never go in those areas. And then in 2000, I don't know, 3 or 4, we moved to Salt Air, which was near Bundy and San Vicente. And so then at that point, I had driven by Nicole's place, which had been, at that time, the front had been redesigned. So it wasn't any longer 875. I think it was changed to 879. The front had been reconfigured. But whenever I do go by there, it's creepy to me, and I feel like ghosts are haunting me. It's horrible. With Marcia, I just wish that she would have not listened to other people saying that I was a bad person or a felon. And after everybody had done all their checks on me, there was nothing in my character, nothing in my background that would have been derogatory. And even I remember the Vanatter and Lang and saying, "Hey, just put her on the stand. Let's deal with it. Deal with it head on." And I remember her saying to me, "I'm going to make an example out of you." And then she wanted to, like, "I don't need you. I have enough circumstantial evidence. Witnesses who sell their story, it ruins their credibility." That's what she told me. And that's why she said I blew her case. And but then again, she said, "Yeah, I have enough circumstantial evidence. I don't need you." There's just such conflicting things. She had already dismissed me, and I hated that feeling. I wish that she had given me another chance. I think I would have been a good witness. At that point, I was like, okay, whatever it takes, I'm going to make sure I'm redeem myself somehow. And that's when I started turning down all kinds of money. And I think I would have been a good witness. I don't know how anybody would prepare for that, but I think I would have, like, after having to deal with her, I think I could have dealt with the defense team. Well, I only watched a little bit of that, but I saw one thing that really bothered me. So they had this lady named Romy Rosemont portray me in the film, on the show. And she's very dramatic, and she comes there talking to Marcia. I don't remember that part because I was pretty scared of her. I thought I had done something wrong, and I was going to be arrested. So I was never that animated. And then the other thing that bothered me was, I talked to the producer, Scott, I can't remember his name, but they show OJ's Bronco running through the intersection, his lights are on. And I said, "Why did you have the lights on?" He goes, for dramatic effect, we wouldn't have been able to have seen him. I said, exactly, that's why I didn't see him. And but that bothered me, because it's like, that's not what happened. And it even says in the book that Jeff Toobin wrote, based on this TV show, the lights were off. And so I didn't like that they changed that, because that was an important reason why I didn't see him. And that was why I thought he was drunk. If he has lights on and he almost hit me, then I would just think he's just speeding too fast. But I had heard a cop friend say, usually when people are driving drunk at night, they forget to turn their lights on. So then that's how they end up hitting people. And that's exactly what I was thinking and why I thought he was drunk that night. So I didn't like that part. That was the whole reason why I didn't see him. Because I didn't see him until I was right on him. And I almost slammed right into him. It was very overwhelming. I felt very irresponsible. I just felt like I had contributed to OJ getting off. At that time, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I felt like I didn't contribute to, but whatever reason I was there, I didn't do my job. And I didn't know, in hindsight, like, that it would be a bad thing. And I turned down over $100,000 from that point, trying to make myself credible in her eyes again. I turned down all kinds of energy, all kinds of money. Even though I'd lost my job because of this case, I had lost my job. I didn't have any money coming, I think, unemployment. It was just changed everyone's life, everyone in my family. It affected everyone. So if I could go back and reverse that, I would never have spoken to Hard Copy. But it is what it is, and it doesn't change my story. I thought at that time, like, oh my God, I'm a horrible person. I've done blood. I felt like I accepted blood money. I felt like this is the worst thing they ever could ever do. And I thought, oh my God, the families are going to hate me. And so I just felt horrible about my actions. And it took me a long time to make peace with it. And I actually got to talk to the Browns and the Goldman, Kim Goldman. And so they helped me with that. I apologized to them. It was just, I felt like it was not the right thing to do. So now in my life, I've learned to let go of that guilt and that feeling. I've learned to heal it. I feel like I'll always be tainted by that night, but it's not all of me, and it's not as big of a sore spot in my life. I realized that I did what I did, but I did not blow the case. There was too many other things that happened during the case and the trial, and I don't think I was the sole reason that OJ was not convicted. My daughter's older, life is good, and I'm able to like talk about this now without feeling like I was part of the bad part of the case. I can talk about it now in a way where I don't feel so horrible about that night. It was a horrible night as it was, but I realized I could not change the outcome. I don't believe that I could have changed the outcome. I think that I've learned to make peace with it. And by talking to other people that were involved in the case, it's made it a lot easier for me. Like, okay, here's what happened. And how can I move forward from this moment on?